Welcome to episode 159 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, where we talk about all things related to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Kelly.
I'm Dermot.
Dermot, what's the news?
Not too much. Everything's great.
Do anything fun lately?
We went to some friends the other night and last night.
Yeah.
And had a good time. Played some board games.
Yeah.
I won.
Dermot, you know, for anyone who's listening for a while, Dermot's been getting into board games the last year or so. He's making that sound because he doesn't want anyone to know his terrible secret. I've been trying to introduce him to games for years, and finally I've succeeded. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to have to admit that he really likes it.
They are fun, yeah. There's always that, like, oh god, new game, what are the rules? Ugh, that's the part I really hate. Mm-hmm.
Yep, yep.
And then they click in your head, and then it's like, oh, okay, I get it now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good for neuroplasticity.
My goal is to get Dermot to play Dungeons & Dragons.
Nah, that's a bridge too far, I think.
Because he knows he'd love it.
Mm. It's at least a Satanism.
You love Satanism.
You summon Beelzebub. You can't be doing that.
We'll set Beelzebub aside for now and talk about us. So, Blooms & Barnacles is a blog as well as a podcast. And we've got a brand new blog post up entitled The Superior, The Very Reverend John Conmee, S.J. Do you remember what that is about, Dermot?
Father Conmee.
Yes.
Who is a priest who in real life is very kind to James Joyce.
Yes.
And seems to have only been a positive influence on him. So Joyce thanks the man by putting him in his book and making hideous mockery of him.
Yes. He would have died before Ulysses was published. So.
Good. Good.
But yeah, he is not too kindly to poor old Father Conmee in Wandering Rocks. And so we cover that in great detail in this blog post. And Dermot did a little bit of artwork for it, as always. And I'd like him to tell you about the artwork now.
All right. It's Father Conmee being obsequious to a fine lady in her Edwardian drag. And meanwhile, he's like kissing her hand and she looks kind of disgusted. And there's a little starving urchin between them with a begging bowl. So
if you want to know why we're being so mean, go read the blog post, which can be found at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Next up, Dermot has also done some artwork for this episode, which is entitled A-E-I-O-U. Now, Dermot, do you remember what this artwork is or what it means?
It's some Aristotelian nonsense about changing forms. The Greeks were obsessed with the problem, as they should be, the problem of change. Not enough people today are obsessed with it either. When one thing changes into another, how do you know when it's one thing and a different thing? And I think Stephen's kicking this through his head about how he owes money. And he thinks, if I'm not the same person who lent the money, like if I'm a few years on and all of my fingernails have grown out and my hair is gone and all the bits of my body. It's a ship of Theseus. The person that lent the money to somebody else doesn't exist anymore. So therefore, I don't owe anybody any of the money I borrowed from them because I'm not the same I, I'm a different I.
Yeah, and we'll put a pin in that because we'll talk about whether or not we think that is a good way to get out of your debts.
Mm.
Because that is baked into today's passage. That's right, everybody. It's an Aristotle episode. Thanks for joining us. I think our last one for a bit now. You may be freed from this terrible curse of having to talk about Aristotle on podcasts.
Good.
A few more mundane shout outs before we get into it. We'd love to thank all of our supporters on Patreon as well as our one-time donors using PayPal. If you'd like to support the show in a monetary fashion, you can head over to our website,
bloomsandbarnacles.com,
and click the donate button in the upper right-hand corner, and you have options. You can use PayPal to make a one-time donation, or you can subscribe monthly over on Patreon, and if you do that, you get all of our episodes early, you have access to a video version for patrons only, and you get patron-only bonus content, and our most recent episode is about Hamlet. Scylla and Charybdis revolves around Hamlet quite a lot. Dermot and I are pretty tepid in our interest of Shakespeare, so we thought we should at least brush up and know Hamlet a little bit while we're talking about this. And we thought the best way to do that is to watch a film version, because none of the farmers are staging Hamlet out here where we live in the middle of nowhere. So we watched the 1948 Laurence Olivier Hamlet, and we talk about it. Talk about the Oedipus complex a lot more than I have any interest in talking about, which is actually good because that's going to come up later in Scylla and Charybdis as well. You can hear us talk about Laurence Olivier and Hamlet and Shakespeare over on patreon.com. If you'd like to keep in touch with us, follow us on socials. My DMs are always open. We're mainly on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky these days. Leave us a review on your platform of choice. And of course, you can always follow our newsletter over at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Scylla.com. Enough with the formalities. Let's get into the episode. We are reading Scylla and Charybdis, the section we're covering today in my edition of Ulysses, which is the 1990 Vintage International Edition, is from pages 189 to 190. We've almost broken 200 pages in the number of years we've been doing this podcast. And we have a little segment I call Last Time on Ulysses. This is what A.E. said just before we ended last time.
Interesting only to the parish clerk. I mean, we have the plays. I mean, when we read the poetry of King Lear, what is it to us how the poet lived? As for living, our servants can do that for us. Villiers de Lille has said, peeping and prying into green room gossip of the day, the poet's drinking, the poet's debts. We have King Lear, and it is immortal. Mr. Best's face appealed to, agreed.
Okay.
So that's A.E. Russell arguing against the idea that you should know anything about the author. Mm-hmm. And the book, the text of the work itself mm-hmm. is sufficient.
That's right.
James Joyce is going to unbelt his trousers and pull them down and do squat and do a great big pile right on top of that thesis.
I guess that does fit in with his artistic ethos to a certain extent. You know, intellectually, he'll do that. It's great meta-commentary on Ulysses, actually, this portion of this episode, yeah. Because the more you know about James Joyce's life, the more you will understand Ulysses. Like, there are little comments and asides and things in this very episode, not today's podcast episode, but Scylla and Charybdis episode. Things only his brother Stanislaus would know, and that we know now because we have access to all of his letters and correspondence. But someone reading this in the 1920s would just never have any way of knowing what it meant.
Yeah.
So
look, if you had a time machine, could go back and let's say Homer mm-hmm. actually wrote the Odyssey, and that's not a composite character or whatever, mm-hmm. but whoever wrote that, right? And we have the biography, and we have like a little, oh, here's the a lost volume, the life of Homer, and oh my God, this is a real person. The scholars mm-hmm. will be on picking that for 50 to 100 years, mm-hmm. correlating it with the Odyssey and the Iliad and trying to figure out
even
what
if
was
we
what.
Just knew, you know, more detailed information about Shakespeare's biography.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, this is the counterpoint. Most of the passage, I think all of the passage we look at today is entirely Stephen's internal monologue. So it's actually quite a short passage that we'll be reading today, but it all takes place inside Stephen's head. So I think it's good to know, just have a refresher of what he's reacting to,
right.
Which is that he has said that Hamlet is based in some part on Shakespeare's own personal tragedy of losing his son Hamnet when he was very young. The play then responds to that and personal tragedy in his life. Then A's like, no, it doesn't. And Stephen's very annoyed by that because in this, he's a very young man. A.E. is one of the most important people in the literary scene in Dublin. Stephen is trying to impress him with his ideas. And he is not only annoyed and grumpy, but just dismissing him out of hand in front of these other guys that all look up to him. That makes Stephen look uncredible. Probably makes him feel pretty bad. You can imagine how that would feel. I don't think I need to say much more.
Yeah.
And then he does a great thing at the end here that you'll see a lot in Ulysses and Scylla and Charybdis particularly, where Joyce will denigrate someone else's idea by having a foolish character agree with that other person's idea.
Right.
So A.E. makes his claim here pretty directly and staunchly, and then it's followed by Mr. Best's face appealed to, agreed. It's like Mr. Best is kind of portrayed as this foolish, boyish presence. It makes it seem like A.E. must have kind of looked at him when he was talking, and he's like, yeah, I agree, yeah.
Galileo did something approximate in his book about the heliocentric mm-hmm. system. The Pope made a very reasonable request to Galileo. He said, mm-hmm. you have my full blessing to write your book. One condition, you explain the different systems, heliocentric, geocentric, Brahe, Capellan, mm-hmm. whatever. But just don't state the heliocentric as fact, because there's not enough evidence. And there wasn't mm-hmm. at the time, actually. What does Galileo do? He writes a book in which there's two characters talking about the different systems. Mm-hmm. This Galilean heliocentric Copernican system and the geocentric one that he's trying to overthrow. And the character who is kind of a proxy for the Pope mm-hmm. is given the name Simplicio. Mm-hmm. And poor Simplicio is clearly a fool. Mm-hmm. Who thinks the Earth's in the middle of the bottom of the universe, which obviously kicked off an awful lot of trouble. So it's nice to see Joyce being kind of in the same category of, I'm going to put the boot in
The idea really is you can demonstrate that AE's ideas are bad by having a doofus agree with them.
Yeah.
Not fair to Mr. Best. No. Now, the difference here between Ulysses and your example is these are real people that Joyce knew.
Right.
And he is writing about them under their own names.
Yes.
In the place where they worked.
In the example of Galileo.
Or at least where Best worked.
In the example of Galileo, it was very clear that Simplicio was meant to be the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
A man who can have you possibly disappeared.
That's true.
Which wasn't smart. It was in fact a very stupid thing to do.
Yeah. And I do want to say on Mr. Best's behalf, he was not a doofus at all in real life.
Right.
Quite the opposite. Joyce personally just didn't like him. We did a whole episode about it. You have to go listen to that.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Very similar. It's like, it's funny now to see there's like both these very, very cocksure men. At least with Joyce, AE can't get you killed.
That's true. Yeah. No, but you'll see a lot of points too where if Haynes likes something, that's Joyce's way of saying, look at this piece of garbage.
Guilt by association.
This idiot likes it. Yeah. Also not fair to the real man that Haynes was based on. None of these people.
No.
I don't think there's really anything wrong with these guys. Joyce just found them kind of dorky. At least with someone like AE, we've talked quite a bit in previous episodes, so I won't belabor the point, but they were artistic tastemakers in Dublin. They decided who got printed and who didn't, and their tastes did not match Joyce's, and that really, I would say, hobbled his artistic career in this era. So I do think that is a significant and serious complaint, but it is not always, sometimes it is portrayed in a petty fashion, as I believe was Joyce's way. Let's linger here no longer. I'm going to have you read the entirety of the passage and give your thoughts on it, so kind of reaching back to how we used to do our Proteus episodes.
Okay.
And then we will go through this line by line and really dig into
this
it.
This is all in Stephen's head.
This is all in Stephen's head. Okay. Yeah.
Flow over them with your waves and with your waters. Mananan, Mananan, MacLear. How now, sirrah, that pound he lent you when you were hungry. Marry, I wanted it. Take thou this noble. Go to, you spent most of it in Georgina Johnson's bed. Clergyman's daughter, Agambite of Inwood. Do you intend to pay it back? Oh, yes. When? Now? Well, no. When then? I paid my way. I paid my way. Steady on. He's from Bay and Boyne Water, the northeast corner. You owe it. Wait. 5 months. Molecules all change. I am other eye now. Other eye got pound. Buzz, buzz. But I, Entelechy, form of forms, am I by memory because under ever-changing forms, I that sinned and prayed and fasted, a child call me saved from pandies, I, and I, A, E, I, O, U.
Your thoughts, Dermot?
So that's the Aristotelian bit at the end there.
At the end there,
he's thinking again, at what point does a thing become a different thing? And there was when I was in America, I got very angry at work once. This was in 2006. I was working at Disney. And there was a man on death row who was being executed. And this poor man had been on death row for 20 years. And he had completely reformed. And they went ahead with the execution anyway. And I thought, if you're going to execute this man for the murder he did commit, then do it, you know, in a decent amount of time when he's at least the same person that did the crime. And it really pissed me off. One of my friends in there, he was kind of conservative, but we were still friends. And he came in sort of like, ha, did they kill that guy? And like, James, fuck off. Like, I do not, if you want to stay my friend, talk to me about this. And he went away. And that's kind of what comes to mind on that. He did, if somebody has completely reformed. But I think he's been sophistic about it here. It was 3 years ago, it wasn't me. Well, I think 3 years is not a sufficient amount of time for a meaningful change.
Well, that's 5 months, he says.
5 months, not even that, yeah. So he's definitely pushing his luck a bit. But it still does raise the philosophical question about, and it was the Greeks obsessed with the problem of change. I think there was a soup that in the ancient Greek times, and you had to stir it and it was nice. And if it just let it congeal for even like, say, 10 seconds, it would clot and it was disgusting. You'd stir it up again and it was really nice. So the question was, at what point is this soup good and at what point is it bad? At what point is it the soup that we know and love and at what point is it like a clump of goo? Because you couldn't tell, right? There's no point of transition where you can go, oink. It's not like water freezing into ice. It's just grades from one to the other. And this obsessed them. And sure, not enough people kind of think about this. Today, they just tend to like wave it off. It's a form of the Socrates paradox when there's a pile of sand. Not one pile. It's not one grain. It's not two. Not three, it's not four. 1,424 grains is going to look like a pile of sand to everybody. So where's the cutoff? Is it 9? Is it 15? Everyone's going to have a different number.
Mm-hmm.
And it could depend on just the visuals. You know, you couldn't even tell. Yeah, just feel it. It's a sense you have. It's, so you get into like things like nominalism. It's mm-hmm. all just names that we apply to this chaotic flux of the external chaotic universe, right? Everything's a continuum. And we make up these names, these categories to describe things. The Greeks wouldn't have liked that nominalistic idea because they did believe there was mm-hmm. like a realness to things like horse. And the categories they believed were sort of ontologically real in some way. And so you have the medieval nominalists who go, no, it's all just names.
We can make the philosophy you can use to fight Graham Linehan on Twitter.
Yeah, they got Graham Linehan with the... He did the whole thing about
what's a chair.
Chair, yeah. He's not a deep thinker. Like I've said before, my favorite chapter in any book is chapter 4 of Evolution of Civilizations by Carol Quigley, which I just bought on a whim in the 1990s because I just liked history, right? And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. But he describes how everything is a continuum and we assign names and categories to explain the... So basically making it a nominalistic argument about things. But again, there are philosophical objections to nominalism, which kind of undercut it. But still, you know, things like the gap between... Imagine a spectrum going from red to yellow. There's a sort of an orange in the middle, but where you put the line that defines in this continuum from one to the other is arbitrary. So these boundary lines that we create to describe everything are arbitrary lines. They're imaginary, and the categories that we make are largely or entirely imaginary. And you can apply it to ethnic groups, racial categories. They're all constructed by people to explain a very irrational external reality that the Greeks disliked. They disliked the rational numbers, and famously the Pythagoreans hated mm-hmm. them, right? So I'm sure this is all the background noise of the Joycean, Dedalesian brain, yeah. And he's trying to use it to wheedle. Instead of like deep thinking, he's trying to use it to see, can he scam his way out of paying back a big chunk of money that it must be a substantial amount if he's like trying to kick it down the road or get out from under it. Because if it was just a few crowns, like he'd pay it over, you know?
It says in Nestor how much it is. It's, I'm not going to try to guess, but it's, you know, it's enough that he could pay it back with a salary that he's just received.
Okay.
But he's also not going to do that.
Okay.
Which is, you know, he's...
Which just makes it worse, right? Because if he could forgive it if it's like, oh God, it's 2 weeks' pay, you know?
Yeah. So anything above the entelechy form of form spit, anything that you're picking up from the rest of this passage?
So the flow over them with your waves, this is like a quote from some... thing that I have no idea what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it's epic Irish with the Mananon, or maybe I'm wrong, could be MacLear. It sounds mythological. How now, Sarah, I'm guessing is Shakespeare. I'm only guessing because it sounds like How now, Sarah sounds vaguely Elizabethan, Jacobinian. Georgina Johnson's bed, clergyman's daughter, Agenbite of Inwith. So Agenbite of Inwith is that medieval phrase that he's got kicking around in his head too. Yeah, so but who is Georgina Johnson? I don't know.
All right, we'll start with Mananon MacLear. He was the Irish sea god. We've talked about him, but it would have been a long time ago back in Proteus.
Yeah.
Where Stephen likens the waves on Sandy Mount Stradd to the steeds of Mananon.
Right.
There is kind of an association with this particular Irish god and AE. They will sometimes kind of appear together. This would be a prime example. So this is Stephen's rebuttal now to what AE had said. He doesn't say it out loud. Kind of like when he was dealing with Mr. Deasy or Miles Crawford, where he's just arguing with them in his head, but he's not necessarily saying it all out loud.
Mm.
You're right, this is a quote from one of AE's own plays entitled Deirdre, and this is a paraphrase of a druid's invocation from that play. Stephen is invoking the sea god to sort of swallow AE beneath the waves, which is what happens in the play, in which the sea god is exhorted to swallow the mythical lovers Deirdre and Naoise beneath the sea. Stephen is just like, oh, he's so frustrated by AE's really negative response that he's just like, I hope the sea swallows you.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and of course, all the problems that Odysseus has throughout the Odyssey are because he angered the sea god Poseidon. You really don't want to mess with a sea god. That's just some free advice to anyone listening. Don't mess with the sea gods. Stephen's reaction is obscure here at first. We can see that he is quite offended by AE's remarks, which are far from kind and gentle, as we've talked about. It's not revealed within the narrative of Ulysses if Stephen's curse against the mystic poet AE was effective. Perhaps it's because Stephen has second thoughts almost immediately. So we don't know if AE gets swallowed by the sea. Yeah, so now it goes, how now, sirrah, that pound he lent you when you were hungry? And it's this sort of little dialectic, which is our art of Scylla and Charybdis, right? Is a conversation between two people. Mm-hmm. It's Stephen and other Stephen inside his head is this particular dialectic. And you're right, yeah, there's some Elizabethan idiom here, sirrah, you see in various Shakespeare plays. So Stephen is roused to anger by A.E.'s mention of the poet's drinking and debts. And A.E.'s remark is in the context of Shakespeare, but Stephen is a poet also involved in a lot of drinking and accumulation of debts. So I think Stephen sees himself in that comment. I don't think that A.E. meant anything like that by it, but Stephen cranks his chain a little bit there. Yeah, and this now reminds him that A.E. lent him money when he was hungry. So his conscience, maybe his Agenbite of Inwit, is saying, he gave you money when you were hungry. And then Stephen's saying, Mary, I wanted it. Like, yeah, I really wanted that money. Take thou this noble. And then Stephen kind of scolds himself and says, you spent most of it in Georgina Johnson's bed, which if you've read all of Ulysses, you will know she is a sex worker with whom Stephen is sort of infatuated. Agenbite of Inwit. So you remember it's from a medieval text. Do you remember what it means?
Something about conscience, isn't it?
Yeah, remorse of conscience. Yes. So he feels guilt.
Yeah.
The next part's clear. Do you intend to pay it back? Oh, yes. When? Now? Well, no. When then? So this is Stephen struggling with that Agenbite of Inwit, right? This is very directly that. The real A.E. made similar loans to James Joyce in 1904 when he had no money and was not eating and not taking care of himself and semi-homeless. And the real James Joyce never paid back all that money borrowed from A.E. and many, many other folks in Dublin. And in this case, he knows that A.E.'s patronage only contributed to the artist's drinking and carousing and did not fund the art that he's purported to be doing. And so Stephen feels that sting of Agenbite of Inwit, the remorse of conscience, which is really what's behind that indignant curse where he's asking the sea god to rise up and swallow A.E. He's mad that this guy isn't responding in the way he wants, but he is kind enough to give freely loans that he probably knew he wasn't going to get paid back. And then I really squandered his charity on things it wasn't meant to pay for. Theoretically, he could repay A.E. with the wages he received that morning, but he is fairly committed to squandering that money rather than making good on his debts. So, like, we've already seen him take the money and take all the guys from the Evening Telegraph to Mooney's for a boozy lunch. So he's just kind of throwing his money away. It's very self-destructive behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. This passage allows Stephen and also Joyce to subvert and refute A.E.'s assertions that so-called green room gossip doesn't make good art, as this rundown of an artist's unseemly behavior is spun into art. I think people would generally agree this is an artistic work. It is full of Joyce's own green room behavior, I guess we're calling it, presented in an artistic fashion, and luckily for Joyce, it is widely appreciated by the populace in general. You could write this novel and nobody like it and be just as arrogant as Joyce was. He's just lucky he actually turned out to be James Joyce. Yeah, a little bit of quasi-Shakespearean flair thrown in here for good measure. His next thought then, I paid my way.
And Mr. Deasy.
You slip back in that Mr. Deasy voice pretty easily.
Yep.
He's remembering what Mr. Deasy said. The reality of unpayable debts jolts Stephen's memory back. He felt kind of shamed by what Mr. Deasy was saying, which we can quote here. So dust off your Deasy voice.
Do you know what is the proudest word you will ever hear from an Englishman's mouth? I paid my way. I never borrowed a shilling in my life. Can you feel that? I owe nothing. Can you?
Stephen was silent then too, responding to Mr. Deasy only in his own mind with a list of unpaid debts. We covered this previously. Ah, okay. I did include here in my notes, he owes Russell 1 guinea.
Okay.
Which is equals £1, 1 shilling.
Mm-hmm.
That is an amount of money Stephen currently has in his pocket.
That's his week's wages, right?
He got £4 for for his salary.
So it's about a quarter of his week's wages.
I think it's a month's wages.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, pound was worth a lot more back in those days.
Right, so that's
pre-decimalization. Okay,
so that's still a decent chunk of money.
It's quite a bit of money.
Yeah, but you pay it off in installments. I could say, I can't give you all of it, but I can give you I'm gonna do it over 3 months.
If we look back at that Nestor passage, Stephen owes a lot of people a lot of money.
Yeah,
and I think feels overwhelmed and so just pays no one anything, which is very bad. But Stephen's association with A.E. and Mr. Deasy runs deeper than a few shillings, though. The next line he says is, steady on. he's from, this word beyond is like beyond Boyne Water, the northeast corner, you owe it. Does that mean anything to you? He's from beyond or beyond Boyne Water.
Is it the Boyne Valley, the Boyne River?
The Boyne River.
And if it's north of that, it's up towards Northern Ireland and Ulster. And
the northeast corner.
That's Ulster, yeah.
Yeah, so what part of Ireland does Mr. Deasy love the most?
Ulster.
Yeah.
Aye.
And A.E. is from...
Is he not from Ulster?
He's from beyond Boyne Water, the northeast corner. That's A.E. he's talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where's he from originally then?
So A.E. was born in Armagh.
Oh, okay.
And he is indeed a northerner and a Protestant.
Oh, okay.
You know, all the things that Mr. Deasy admires.
Right. Again, remember, this is pre-partition, so, you know, there'd still be a sense that Ulster is a different province, but it would be a province of a 32-county part of the UK, you know.
Yeah, I think more heavily Protestant part because of the plantation of Ulster.
Oh, yeah, no, heavily, heavily. Back then, like, I was born in 1969, and the census data from then is something like, from Ulster, the six counties. I think it was, like, pushing 70%, and... how quickly it's changed just in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. The Catholic and the last census were the majority population group. So, but yeah, but this time it would might have been even more than 70. Would it be in that range?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the part that was settled by the Ulster Scots.
Okay. So. Well, that's where A.E. is from.
Okay.
He, you know, was born Protestant. He is from Armagh, which, if you're not familiar with Ireland, is in current-day Northern Ireland. It makes Stephen wonder if he shares Mr. Deasy's worldview as well, that he's also the old fogey and Tory, as Mr. Deasy called himself. You know, he's very money-obsessed and obsessed with being debt-free and never borrowing anything and doing it all yourself. A.E. really is not like that at all. But Stephen's wondering if there's some kind of cultural affinity there where he's going to get really come down hard on Stephen for owing all these debts.
Right.
You know, another Mr. Deasy connection too is that part of Stephen's mission in the library is to deliver Mr. Deasy's foot and mouth letter to A.E. In Nestor, he gives him this big letter about foot and mouth disease, and he's like, you have contacts in the media, you know, go give them this and see if they'll print it. He does that with Miles Crawford and Aeolus, and now he's here with A.E., who is the editor of the Irish Homestead, which is an agricultural journal. So Stephen has to try to introduce him in Mr. Deasy's letter, which we'll come to in a later passage, but I guess I'll spoil it for you, is that A.E. kind of politely feigns interest, and Stephen knows that he's failed to get this letter to the editor into the Irish Homestead. A.E. says if he considers it important, it will go in. We have so much correspondence, so probably assume that letter's not going in. So there's one more interesting overlap in Stephen's perception of these two men who vex him so. He associates A.E. with Mananon, the sea god, like we mentioned. And in this passage from Nestor, where Mr. Deasy brags about how great and responsible he is with his finances, Stephen thinks the sea's ruler, his sea-cold eyes looking on the empty bay, right? And you usually kind of interpret that as, like, the British Empire's the sea's ruler, right? And that's generally how that's read, but there is a Homeric parallel to those comments as well. We said Odysseus struggled to find his way home for so long because he ran afoul of Poseidon, the sea's ruler. Stephen is beset on all sides by sea gods, whether they be English or Irish. A.E. is but one more sea god that's bedeviling Stephen. He just can't catch a break. But suddenly, an escape hatch appears, and we hit Dermot's favorite lines here. Wait. 5 months. Molecules all change. I am other eye now. Other eye got pound.
It's like a caveman. Yeah. Other eye got pound.
Stephen's saying that all of his molecules have changed, which Dermot very deftly explained, and so that he's a different... If all of his molecules are different now, then he's a different Stephen. I am other eye now. Other eye got pound. Not I. Other eye. So Stephen has discovered a loophole to his debtorship. He's a totally new person. With totally new molecules. And it was the old molecules that borrowed that stupid guinea from A.E. in the first place. His form is ever changing, like the endless procession of tides in the ocean. He is unbound like Proteus, a totally different sea god. Checkmate, A.E. Do you have some thoughts on this?
Well, like, if you follow this through, nobody would be able to write contracts or do anything to anybody. It would be pure chaos.
You'll be glad to know it's Stephen's Aristotelian mindset that brings him back down to earth. Oof. For the end of this passage, which I'll reread now. But I, Entelechy, form of forms, am I by memory because under ever-changing forms. I that sinned and prayed and fasted, a child conned me saved from pandies. I. I. A-E-I-O-U. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the great puns there.
Yeah.
Don't have to explain that. Anyway, speaking of sea monsters, Aristotle rises from the depths once more like Godzilla, torment the nation's capital. Stephen may be subject to shifting protean metamorphoses on the surface, but each version of Stephen is tied to past and future versions of Stephen on a deeper level. Yes, Stephen was once a devoutly religious youth and is now a slightly older blasphemer. But those people are both Stephen. We all recognize that. We recognize that in ourselves and basically everyone we know, that we all change in some ways, but we all remain ourselves all the same. He was once a weedy little boy, cowering under physical abuse at Clongowes Wood College, and now he boldly speaks his mind to prominent, respected men. Caution be damned. So we see Father Conmee as referenced here, so this would be a reference to material from A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. A child Conmee saved from pandies. Do you know what pandies are?
Only through this. It's like little bully boys.
No, it's bully adults.
Oh.
So Stephen broke his glasses on accident in Portrait, and so he couldn't study as a result because he couldn't see anything.
Right.
I don't remember the name of the priest who was his teacher, but he basically convinced himself that this young boy had broken his glasses on purpose so he wouldn't have to study, which doesn't really square with my idea of Stephen Dedalus. But he's like, no, you broke those on purpose, so now you have to be punished because you can't study for a day or so while they're being repaired. So you have to go then to another priest for a pandy. What that means is they have a pandy bat, which is a big flat wood paddle basically that you lean over a desk and then they beat you with it. Mm-hmm. That's the pandy bat. And when Father Conmee saw that this was happening, he stepped in and saved Stephen. Okay. And said his glasses broke. He didn't do it on purpose. Don't be ridiculous. And so Stephen was, you know, about to be physically abused by this priest, and Conmee saved him from that because mm-hmm. he recognized like that's not really in his character to do that. So yeah, and that's, as far as I'm aware, a real story from Joyce's life. There's a lot of physical abuse in those schools.
Sounds legitimate.
Even a high-end school like Clongowes, those kids. Yeah. So he's thinking now, like, he's a bolder adult man, but he both is and isn't that little child cowering in fear that he was going to be physically beaten.
Yeah.
And he says, I that sinned, prayed, and fasted. A lot of Portrait 2 deals with him in his Belvedere years, kind of genuinely considering the priesthood, particularly becoming a Jesuit, which had been an obvious career path for someone like Stephen. But I think he enjoyed spending time with people like Georgina Johnson more. And so that kind of derailed his Jesuitical ambitions. But he became very zealous in his faith for a while, where he was fasting and doing things like that. They're a little more extreme. Which, as we see Stephen in Ulysses, he's not. He's a little bit less saintly, a little less ascetic than that, so. Yet, each of these young men are Stephen, all the same. Each a different version of his I, but always persistently I. They're all different, and they're all the same. How is that possible? Anyway, because of this, yeah, he still owes the guy a guinea. Even if it's a different eye, there's still something that, there's some thread that ties all of these together. Most of us wouldn't have to be convinced of this societal truth, but what would Aristotle say? WWAS. We have to ask this question because Stephen used the phrase entelechy, form of forms. This is the key to this philosophical riddle. We've discussed in a previous blog post that form of forms refers to Aristotle's conception of the soul. I have a blog post called Form of Forms that deals with this phrase. It's tied to passage in Nestor. We did record that as a podcast, but it's episode 2 on our Patreon. So go over there to listen for more Aristotle content. If this is not enough for you. Form of forms refers to Aristotle's conception of the soul. That alone is enough to grasp Stephen's conclusion here. Just knowing that that's the meaning of form of forms, entelechy, form of forms, the soul. The soul is what makes you you the whole time. Even as your meat body changes, your ideas change, you still possess the same soul. His soul is eternal and unchanging. It's the soul, the form of forms, that results in the persistence of Stephen as a continuous identity, even if the superficial aspects change. So because Stephen has a soul, he must repay his debts. What about entelechy? Do you know what entelechy means?
Oh god, it's one of those words I can look it up and then forget it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, same here, so that's why I have all these notes I'm reading from. It's an anglicization of the Greek word entelecheia. This term, coined by Aristotle, is a portmanteau of several ancient Greek words and was never defined by Aristotle. Did you find this information helpful?
Nope.
Oh, but wait, there's more. So in the book Aristotelian Interpretations by Joycean scholar and Aristotelian scholar Fran O'Rourke, he explains that entelechy has a similar meaning to essence, form, or eidos, E-I-D-O-S, another ancient Greek word. The soul, in Aristotle's view, O'Rourke says, is, quote, the first actuality, entelechy, of a natural body endowed with organs. It's the special something that makes a human rather than a pile of meat or a corpse. Its persistence creates a stable identity within that meat body. So the question being answered here is, what's the difference between a human and a corpse? The form is the same, but we recognize instinctually that they're not the same. There's something about living me that's different from my future form of dead me.
Mm.
What is it? For Aristotle, it's the soul animating the meat body. That's what gives you your identity, is this inviolable, persistent form within a form that maintains that stable identity over time.
Right.
And it also, that's why you still owe your debts even if all your molecules change. So O'Rourke also explains that entelechy acts as a stabilizing force in the face of change. Entelechy is a, quote, fully actualized perfection of something once it has attained its goal and completed its action, unquote. I think this may be partly what Stephen is driving at in his odd, pompous retort to Eglinton a few paragraphs further on into Scylla and Charybdis, when he says, quote, a man of genius makes no mistakes. His errors are volitional and are the portals of discovery. Shakespeare, a man of genius, represents just such a fully actualized perfection. A state that persists throughout his artistic work, itself an extension of his soul. So Shakespeare's stable identity can extend much further than his physical form because of this fully actualized perfection. If this is true for Shakespeare, it might also be true for Stephen Dedalus. And naturally, Stephen Dedalus shares his form of forms, his entelechy, with his creator James Joyce, a man who knows a thing or two about volitional errors. So his fully actualized perfection, his soul, can also extend further and further beyond his physical form, so that two yokels talk about it on a podcast 100 years later. That's it. That's entelechy, form of forms.
Okay.
Do you feel like you understand it? Stephen remains Stephen, even if his personality changes, his body changes. Any physical, superficial aspect can change, but he remains Stephen because of his unchanging, everlasting soul.
Right.
So he tries to wiggle out of a debt. Basically, his Jesuit education steps in, first guilts him and shames him, and then logics its way through why he still owes the money. He ends with a fantastic pun, A-E-I-O-U.
Hmm.
One would have to imagine he thought of that first and worked backwards from it, but who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can tell, like, the mature writer clearly is feeling guilty too,
mm-hmm. about
his youthful, and probably too embarrassing. At a certain time removed, it's just embarrassing to pay back the money.
Yeah.
So you just let it ride. Like you know, when you have emails you need to answer and they just slide down and you go.
That feeling well.
They're on page 3, 4, 5, 6. Just don't answer them. Everyone's forgotten. Move on.
Mm-hmm. But your conscience remembers. You should pay back the money.
I'm still haunted by debts, not financial debts, mm-hmm. but things I should have done for people that helped me. Mm-hmm. Even now I'm 56 years old. I'm like, oh, why didn't I do this? Or why didn't I say that? Stupid idiot, you know? But I'm talking to my 20-something-year-old self for should have done things differently. Mm-hmm. But you know, I can relate to that. Yeah, he must have felt, oh, I should have paid that money back.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. I know which podcast I was listening to. It's the most recent Comedy Bang Bang. But they're talking about, like, famous people who are roommates.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who specifically the people were. But they were like, two people whose names you would know immediately. It's just slipping my mind which ones they are. Somebody asks the one of them, like, what would you, you know, say to this guy who used to be your roommate? What would you say about him? And it was like, you know, dozens of years since they'd been roommates in university. And he says, he still owes me $3.36. Jesus. I was David Lynch. It was a guy who was David Lynch's roommate. He reached out to him when Blue Velvet was a big success and congratulated him. And that's what David Lynch said back to him. That's great. You still owe me $3 from 1960, whatever. Jeez. People do appreciate when you pay them back. Uh-huh. People remember those even petty little debts like that. What does David Lynch need $3 for?
Yeah, but he needed it back then. Oh, I lend people books and they lost them. This pisses me off. Yeah. Like, I didn't lend you that book so you could lose it. I wanted it back.
Yeah. I always feel like if you're lending a book or a movie or whatever, people don't lend CDs and movies as much anymore. But once you put it in the other person's hand, you have to kind of major peace with it because it might not come back.
Yeah.
I've been too generous too many times. And sometimes I've been the book loser or the book destroyer too. You don't mean to do it. And just, you know. Mm-hmm. So your books may come and go, but you maintain a stable form because you have a soul, Dermot.
There was his famous Islamic theologian scholar called Al-Ghazali and died in 1111 AD. And the story of him is that he was robbed by brigands on the road one day and they were stealing all of his books. Mm-hmm. And Ghazali began to like cry, was very upset. He said, please take all my gold and everything, but don't take my books. And the robber just looked at him and said, you mean to tell me that if we take these books, you will be lesser of a man? And Ghazali says, yes, I need them. And the guy just looked at him with this like look of such contempt that Ghazali determined that he would never again allow himself to be reduced to that state by losing a book. So that's when he committed to memorizing it all, because he didn't want to have this part of him to be external to him. He wanted it all to be internal.
Yeah.
So he's one of the like fundamental figures in Islam. Well, that was an interesting, like mental discipline that you had to have back in the day to, you know, with books and text. Granted, they didn't have the volume we do now. Yeah, so he wanted the continuity of Al-Ghazali to be inside himself and not, you know, whatever he had in his bookshelf.
That reminds me, God, I hadn't thought about this in years, but I used to think about this all the time. I had a history professor in college. He had gotten his PhD very late in life, like in his 50s or 60s. He said he decided to do it because when he was in middle age already, that he had this fancy job at a bank, and then he lost the job and the bank went under and his wife left him, and he started getting very sick from Agent Orange exposure and like everything, and you know, like his estranged from his kids, and just like everything just disintegrated in his life at once until he had nothing.
Yeah, being there, done that, I don't recommend it.
And he said that he basically looked at the world and thought, you can take everything from me. The next thing I have in life, I want to be something that no one can take from me. That caused him to go back to school then and pursue history as a professional discipline, because he thought, you can take everything from me. You can take every penny in my bank account. You can take my house. You can take my health. Take every book on my shelf, but I'll still have the knowledge in my mind.
Same mentality, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see, we live in an age where the dominant attitude, especially among young people, is the opposite of that, where they're externalizing things that they should be making internal. Mm-hmm. Like the influencer mentality, the clout mentality with social media, the brute materialistic, like get your bag mentality, where you just make lots of money. And as somebody, I did all that and it all got taken away. And you will have no control when it happens. None. Mm-hmm. And what you describe, I've actually lived that. And there's nothing that you can do. If life decides it's going to do it to you, somebody that you love will just have a lump on their body and then they're dead in 2 years. Like that's how it will operate, and there is no amount of anything that will stop the thing that's coming for you. And you can't sell that to kids today or young people today, because they just haven't experienced it. And they've been sold a particularly virulent lie by, let's call it, end stage capitalism, that you can have it all if you just work hard enough. And I had it all. And then the medieval wheel of fortune, when that fucker turns, it can turn really fast. And like 1999, you're on top of the world. And 2002, you're having basically a systemic emotional mental breakdown. Then you tried not to get crushed by it, but I don't think a lot of the younger people today have. I had things in my head that helped me, and I don't think they have those things in their heads. I think their heads are full of Star Wars and Marvel movies.
That might be how they learn those things, because some of those things, you can read all the right books and have big ideas in your head, but I think what really teaches you how to go through those experiences is having gone through them already.
Well, it helps to have something
sure.
than Yoda or Iron Man.
But if that's all you have, you can still learn those skills, but you have to learn it by doing. And you can think that you're prepared. But I think that that is also a false sense of security. It's just maybe a security blanket with a stronger weave than the Star Wars one. But it's still like... What builds that resilience is experiencing that disintegration and then realizing that it doesn't break you.
Well,
pass through it.
Some people will break. That's the problem.
And but even if you do, you can come back from it. Like that's
some people just check. I could have easily said fuck this and checked out. Like it's,
but you didn't.
I didn't, but I could have.
But you didn't.
It was close enough, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I could have. And it was a contingent fact, not a necessary fact, that I came out the other end. And I think a lot of people are going to go through it in much greater numbers the next time we have like a major crisis. And I just,
How people learn their depth, because you can also imagine a very, very clever philosophy major in university who knows everything about philosophy.
Oh, yeah, I can do them no good.
But they
all,
have no grip on the experiences that make that reify that philosophy.
It's theoretical for them.
Yeah. Maybe it's not, or people get very into religion, I think could be kind of the same way. Like you have all the ideas about what God is and what that whole realm is like. But when you face a crushing loss in your life, you might feel like God has abandoned
you.
Well,
again, I think a lot of people, I think we're heading into a golden age of cults because we've been watching, getting back to like one of our other topics, AI, and
I've been strategically avoiding mentioning it because I think I talk about AI too much.
We put this at the end anyway.
Put our Could AI Write Ulysses video on YouTube.
Yes.
It's been on the Patreon. We did a live talk in June, but we really liked the video. We felt like we did a really good job with it. So it is on our YouTube page for you to watch free of charge, and I strongly encourage you to do so. I think we did a good job with that.
We're watching other videos on YouTube of people talking about people developing religious associations with the AI, thinking it's God, and getting very cultic about it, and kind of in a genuinely disturbing way.
Those videos of people talking about their ascension AIs are, I find, disturbing in a way that I didn't expect to be disturbed.
Yeah, it's quite
I would say the thing I was like, because I was just like, I don't want to get into a conversation with Dermot about AI. I'm trying to wrap this episode.
It's fine.
But I think if you get your philosophy from Yoda, it's not a very solid philosophy. I agree with you there. But I think I don't really care. Like, that might be a stepping stone to something more serious. Like, I've talked to lots of professors who say, like, every time there's, like, a big ancient Greek movie, like 300 or something like that,
they get an influx.
There's a huge number of people that sign up to their ancient Greek classes. Yeah. They don't all stick around. But mundane things can be stepping stones to higher things. Yeah. So I don't think you should completely dismiss Yoda. If you stop at Yoda, it might just be a fun thing. It's not real philosophy, though. But I don't want to talk about Yoda. What I do want to talk about, that doesn't concern me at all because, you know, it's a link to other experiences. What concerns me is people who would use something like ChatGPT and consider it to be the super intelligence, which it's not. See our video, Couldn't AI Write Ulysses? And outsource their thinking to this machine. And if they have any questions, they just ask the machine and it tells them. And then they believe the machine, and some of these people end up worshipping the machine.
Having psychotic breaks, I think.
That to me is far more disturbing because if you watch Empire Strikes Back and when Yoda says, do or do not, there is no try, and it kind of blows your mind, you're still thinking about something. Like, you're thinking your own thoughts. It's just not the same as like going to a robot and having it just tell you what it thinks you want to hear.
Yeah. So. You know who put that quote on the wall of their business?
Steve Jobs.
Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos. And then she went bankrupt and ended up in jail for 10 years.
She did something. she went for the do method. Now, what she did do turned out to be massive fraud.
But probably got people killed with false positives and false negatives.
But she, look, Liz did a real thing, though. She set out to make a thing. It didn't work. And then they faked a lot of medical data. But she did it. She didn't just tell ChatGPT, make me the schematics for a little blood machine.
That's true.
She did that, you know, as I think a result of having access to far too much capital.
Yeah.
Not commensurate with her actual ability. But man, like, that's what a sorcerer is. It's just someone who's very charismatic with their words and their presence, and they make things happen in reality that that weren't there before. So Liz is a sorcerer. That's how I tend to see her. Even if it's a bad idea, props to you for thinking of it and taking the time to just think a thought. Like, don't ask the machine to think for you, even if you're thinking about Yoda. Because we were all a young person at some point thinking about Yoda. Both me and you were that person at some point. Dermot doesn't want anyone to know, but he loved Star Wars at one time. He doesn't like it now, but he did. He loved Star Wars. He watched the Star Wars Holiday Special on TV. No. He watched it on TV in the 70s.
I did, and I was mortified for George Lucas. Eight-year-old me was like shocked how horrible
That's how much he liked Star Wars. He saw all those movies. He was enchanted by them as a kid, just like we were. He tries to float around on his little cloud talking about Al-Ghazali and the other stuff like this and Aristotle. But
what got me into Islam? I got into Islam at the age of 8.
We have to cut all this out, Dermot. This is so far from our episode.
Yeah, one of my teachers came back from a trip to the Middle East, told me about Islam. This religion sounds really interesting. How do I join? I've also had like a graph for all kinds of things.
To wrap this up.
Yes.
Because we'll just keep doing this for hours.
That's at the back end. People can listen or not.
Is the little boy who loved Star Wars and the little boy who loved Islam and the little boy who didn't love Star Wars anymore.
Yeah.
And whatever else, they're all you and they're all not you, but they're all connected by your form of forms.
Okay.
The persistent.
There's a lot of that stuff for your childhood eternal, carries through. Yeah.
An unbreakable form of your soul ties you back to that little boy who is so different from you and yet still you and yet not.
Yeah.
And yet you.
It's a strange thought for sure.
If you look back at yourself when you were 10 years old watching Star Wars.
I was 8.
Okay.
When I came out, 8 or 9. Ooh. Yeah, no, it was great. It was great. We loved it. Well, I love it. It's nothing like it, you know. It was like someone's on Flash Gordon.
And
it's cool.
A year later, when you were a very disappointed little boy watching the Christmas spectacle special. Of life day unfold before your eyes.
That was like a very harsh lesson in growing up. I think I grew up a little bit that day.
Yeah, everyone has a moment, I think. There's some movie that many people have where they're like, oh, movies can be bad sometimes.
And not just bad, but embarrassing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So we have to just stop talking.
That's okay.
Thank you for listening. Check out our social media. Check out patreon.com/barnaclecast. And check out our YouTube page. We never plug that enough, but put our Could an AI Write Ulysses talk up there. So it's not the one we did at the Joyce Center. We expanded it and recorded it here in our little home studio / sitting room. So basically we could waffle on more like we're doing now. Do check that out, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, see you then.
Bye.